Ladies and gentlemen, a good morning to you. This is John Cameron Swayze in the NBC newsroom in New York. People in the news speak out about the world situation. More violence in the Holy Land. In France, the next move of the communist-led strikers is awaited. In this country, there is news of moment from the capital and elsewhere. And for the first time, a claim has been filed on water before it ever leaves the sky. We'll explain, but first, your announcer.
In many cities in Europe, the tuberculosis rate is up 300%. Think of the death and suffering that would mean in your hometown. Multiply it by several hundred towns, and you'll have an idea of the trials of the people of Europe. In many cities in Europe, some more than half of the babies born during the coming year will be dead before they reach their first birthday. You can help save lives if you will contribute $10 to CARE, C-A-R-E, the Overseas Relief Agency. $10 will send over 21 pounds of carefully selected foods, or a bundle of clothing or yard goods and thread. Send your $10 today, in time for Christmas. Send your $10 to CARE, C-A-R-E, New York City, New York. You will receive a signed receipt on delivery. Now, back to the NBC newsroom.
Prime Minister Mackenzie King of Canada spoke overnight, and a review of his remarks this morning shows them to be singularly pessimistic. Mr. King told the Canadian House of Commons the European situation is worse than at any time since before World War II. He is tremendously distressed over the deadlock in the London meeting of the foreign ministers, and he went on to say there are indications Russia is seeking establishment of a central government for Germany, which would be directed from Moscow. The other side of the story, so to speak, comes from Harold Stassen, who says he is optimistic. Presidential hopeful Stassen says he does not predict a third world war, that we can win without it through use of strength, consistency, humanitarianism, and patience in international policies. The patience which Stassen mentioned is stressed by another speaker in the news, Warren Austin, chief American delegate to the United Nations. Mr. Austin predicts it may take years for Russia and the United States to agree on atomic energy control. But, says he, we must convince Russia that our strength is not a threat to her existence or welfare. And then Mr. Austin flatly labeled Russia's plan for atom bomb control a fraud on the people of the world. Meanwhile, on the world scene, some observers profess to see a ray of light at the London Foreign Ministers' Conference, of which Mackenzie King spoke with so much dismay. The ministers are getting into German reparations and other issues which have been deadlocked, and some predictions are heard that Russia will work with the other members of the Big Four in solving problems of Germany's future. These are predictions only, and the possibility remains that Molotov will agree to nothing and that the conference will be abruptly concluded. Elsewhere, little can be found to cheer about this morning. More Jews have been killed in Tel Aviv, and gunfire has been heard throughout most of the morning hours inside the old walled part of Jerusalem. In Paris, the communist labor leaders indicate they'll defy the government ultimatum to the workers to return to their jobs tomorrow or suffer severe penalties. Up-to-the-minute details from both France and Jerusalem will be reported from overseas. In Rome, the communists are showing some indecision in calling the general strike in Rome province, which they had threatened for midnight tonight if the government did not agree to their demands. They've put off deciding about it until tomorrow. At home, the leader of the Communist Party in the United States implies the Reds might back Henry Wallace for president in 1948. William Z. Foster, National Communist Party chairman, spoke here in New York, referred to possible creation of a third party, and soundly praised Wallace and the policies he advocates. In the Capitol today, the matter of foreign aid is by no means settled. A closed meeting is planned concerning some reported domestic shortages. These and other topics will be dealt with shortly by Mr. Reed during our morning stop in the Capitol. The weather is making news over the nation. A sleet storm has hit parts of New England. There is a cold wave from Canada, centering in the Great Lakes area and in parts of the Northwest. Phone lines are down in sections of Iowa. There is rain in a number of southern states and heavy snows in some western mountain areas. Coldest spot, Pembina, North Dakota, with 17 below. This is, of course, Meatless Tuesday. And at McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary in Washington State, some 250 of the inmates went on a hunger strike Sunday night against Meatless Tuesday and Eggless Thursday. Now to get news direct from the scene. Our first report comes from the Holy Land. Here's John Donovan in Jerusalem.
Unconfirmed reports from Tel Aviv say that 70 Arabs were killed in yesterday's fighting near that city. To most of us here in Palestine, this report appears to be grossly exaggerated. 4 Jews and 2 Arabs have been killed in Palestine disturbances this morning, however. The fighting along Jaffa-Tel Aviv borders has quieted down to occasional sniping, but 4 British police armored cars were attacked in this area this morning. A number of sources report that the attackers of the armored cars were Jews. Observers are of the opinion that if Jews are attacking the British, they are members of extremist bands. Most of the Jews of Palestine are displeased with the British, but only extremists are taking up arms at this time against the Mandate power. Responsible Jewish quarters say that the British are handicapping the Jewish security measures by confiscating Jewish weapons of defense. For this reason, Jewish defense forces, the Haganah, are going ahead with security measures, in many cases without consulting or advising the British administration. A report from Amman Transjordan says that King Abdullah refused permission for Iraqi troops to pass through Transjordan. It is common knowledge in the Arab world that King Abdullah is the only Arab leader who regards the partition of Palestine favorably because he will have a chance to annex Arab Palestine. Because of the intrigue and the conniving which surrounds King Abdullah's plans for Palestine, almost any report from Transjordan might be true. But it has been learned from reliable sources that King Abdullah is planning to staff his armies with Iraqi officers as soon as the British officers leave active duty. This is John Donovan in Jerusalem.
Next, the situation in France at this moment. Our reporter, Paul Archinard, in Paris.
The French strike movement is today reaching a state of decay, although the Federation of Labor has turned down government proposals which preclude payment for strike days, but accept to pay 15,000 francs monthly premiums to workers, providing they are back on the job by tomorrow. The Central Strike Committee, which is a communist organization, calls for continued resistance on the part of strikers. And yet a large back-to-work movement is manifest, and new strikes do not develop. Only from 2 to 25% of the state employees, according to the regions in which they work, have followed cease-work instructions. And the Paris subway strike was a complete fizzle. One subway motorman was found carrying security gadgets removed from 9 traction cars. He's coming up for trial as a first horrible example to be prosecuted. Troops from Germany are systematically clearing out mines, factories, and railway stations, especially in the north. But quiet is not yet reestablished in that part of the country. Strikers in Valenciennes this morning sounded bugle calls all over town to rally people for a march on the prefecture. Acts of sabotage haven't stopped. A train jumped the track in Lyons last night, and only sheer luck prevented casualties. Power lines are damaged, and assaults on workers are reported from many places. Attacks come from other directions now, however. Several Communist Party headquarters in central France have been wrecked by grenades. This morning, the Soviet embassy in Paris announced that the French repatriation mission in Moscow had been invited to leave Russia immediately as their own is leaving France. This is an answer to a police raid on a Russian repatriation camp near Paris 2 weeks ago. This is Paul Archinard in Paris.
And now to England. Here's Merrill Muller in London.
Fresh from his diplomatic gain over Russia's Molotov, Secretary of State George Marshall sought the company of a real communist baiter at luncheon today, Winston S. Churchill. It was not, however, to be a business luncheon. Both Mr. and Mrs. Churchill and Ambassador and Mrs. Douglas were to be the secretary's guests in a day that has several of social engagements after the strenuous hours of weekend conferences which the secretary put in. Somebody made a slip on the invitations. Mrs. Douglas is in the United States. Tonight, the secretary will dine with members of the royal family, headed by the Duke of Gloucester, although the king and queen are not expected to be present. Marshall and the Duke of Gloucester are old friends. Meanwhile, the Council of Foreign Ministers remains in suspense until this afternoon, when it again meets in an echo chamber of old problems coming forth in new language. Both the American and British delegations lost all optimism that they may have felt after Molotov's reluctant bending to the will of the other three at yesterday's session. Both delegations knew Molotov would avoid responsibility for breaking this conference by submitting the new document which Mr. Marshall asked for and then compromising on discussion of the British document. But both delegations now say that optimism has waned again after closer study of the new Russian statement, which reveals a bold maintenance of her former position to bleed Germany white on reparations, gain further control of the country, and convert it to communism. The cardinal principles on which a showdown clash must now, in all probability, come this week, remain unchanged. The Americans, unless Molotov wriggles free again, expect the clash about Friday. This is Merrill Muller in London.
For details of the Washington stories mentioned earlier, plus other news of the morning, here's Lee Feed in Washington.
The enemies of the European relief bill came so close to killing it by amendment yesterday that they'll try again today. Killing amendment killing by amendment works this way. A bill will say, for instance, that so many dollars shall be spent on something. You kill it by an amendment saying that nothing in this act shall be construed as authorizing the Treasury to pay out one nickel for purposes mentioned in Section A. They almost had the relief bill by an amendment saying that nothing could be sent overseas that we haven't got enough of here. That would have knocked out food, fuel, and fertilizers, all short in this country. And you can't do much relief without food. But it was close, 11 votes, and today there'll be another on fertilizers and farm machinery before the let's cut down amendments begin coming up for votes. Still, the House leadership expects to get the bill through, if not today, then tomorrow. Otherwise, this morning, Republican Senator Whip, or Senator Wherry, rather, says he doesn't think there'll be time enough before Christmas to do anything about controlling the cost of living. He blames it on the Truman administration for not saying what it wants. This morning, that closed-door meeting of the Commerce Committee will be about coal and oil. This morning, the atomic worker strike at Oak Ridge is off indefinitely. The union and the operating company will fight it out, but over the conference table. This morning, some of last year's touring senators who got a cold turned on from the Greek government on how many casualties there are in the guerrilla war suspect that the Greek army, fattened and armed by this country, isn't doing much fighting. They also want to know why our own army destroyed 2,000 B-17 bombers in Germany when France and Italy could have used them. This is Leif Eid in Washington.
Two stories in the morning report are out of the ordinary. One from Reno, Nevada, telling of what is believed to be the first claim ever filed on water still in clouds. The 12,000-acre Rocking F Ranch has formally filed a claim on all the water in clouds passing over the ranch. A spokesman said the owners plan to make artificial rain next spring, and they want to be sure it belongs to them legally. And the other chronicle is out of Tyler, Texas, where a student pilot cranked a plane which started down the runway empty before he could climb in. It took off and out flew pursuers. About 3 hours later, a farmer called to say a plane had landed in his pasture and there was no one in it. The small plane had taken off. It had flown for 3 hours, landed in a pasture when the gasoline ran out with extremely little damage, all without a pilot or even a robot aboard. More news in a moment. Now your announcer.
Improvements are always welcome, and improvements are needed in most American schools. More and better teachers are needed, as are books, equipment, and new and improved buildings. These changes are not luxuries. They are absolute necessities. Many parents are not aware of the poor school conditions which exist in their communities. How long has it been since you are inside your local school on a business visit? A visit where you carefully examine the building, equipment, and personnel. It might be a very good idea for you to drop in some morning or afternoon and see conditions for yourself as they really are. And if conditions don't meet with your approval, then it's up to you to act. Do something about them. Join one of the many parent groups fighting for better school conditions. Or if such a group does not exist in your community, organize your own group. Surely your children are worth fighting for. It's up to you to see to it that your schools are worthy of your children. And now, once again, back to the NBC newsroom.
Hopscotching the globe. In Nuremberg, Germany, Alfred Krupp, chief defendant before the American War Tribunal in the trial of Krupp munitions officials, has been turned down in his request for American counsel. He wanted to hire a California law firm. In the United States, another store has adopted the spreading practice of selling goods to the customers wholesale and charging a flat fee. The plan originated not long ago at a Philadelphia butcher shop, which has enjoyed thriving patronage. Latest to try it is John Troyce, a grocer of Asbury Park, New Jersey, who charges customers $1 a week, sells at wholesale. Customers have almost swamped him. And in the sports world, the summer fight outdoors between Joe Louis and Jersey Joe Walcott is all set if Walcott says yes, which he probably will. That's the story, folks. Glad we could get together. This is John Cameron Swayze saying goodbye from the NBC newsroom in New York.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
This is Morgan Beatty speaking for Alka-Seltzer, bringing you news of the World Night Special. Tonight, International, that old devil post-war chaos is on the run. Paris, same here. Hollywood, but the ideological memory lingers on. New York, there's human relations in the news. Those are the headlines. I'll be back in a moment with News of the World.
Now a message to all you Christmas shoppers. It's about those long days of trudging from store to store, hunting maybe for just the right gift for Uncle Tom and Aunt Bertha, who have everything to begin with. But more specifically, it's about that shopper's headache that may happen along in the middle of the afternoon when the shopping doesn't seem even half done. Well, now, this doesn't have to be a picture of despair, because you can drop by any drugstore and ask for a glass of sparkling, comforting Alka-Seltzer. Yes, at any drugstore soda fountain, you can find the headache relief you want simply by drinking a glass of refreshing Alka-Seltzer. Try it. And say, while you're there at the drugstore, buy a couple of packages of Alka-Seltzer and take them home with you. It's a good plan to keep your home well supplied with Alka-Seltzer, and you will if you'll just make it a practice always to keep an extra 30 or 60 cent size package on hand. Headaches can happen along at home, you know, just as they can when you're downtown shopping. So keep prepared. Always keep an extra package of Alka-Seltzer handy, or an extra package on the side keeps the family well supplied. Good advice. And if you heed it, you'll have Alka-Seltzer when you need it. Now Alka-Seltzer brings you the noted commentator, author, and reporter, Morgan Beatty.
Tonight we start with a scene in a quiet restaurant a few blocks from the White House in Washington. A group of men, well informed on world affairs, are arguing the same subject many Americans have discussed over a snack in front of the fireplace on Sunday night. The subject, Soviet-American relations and why they don't tick. The time not so long ago, in the early fall, speaking is an American observer with many a hash mark of experience on his figurative coat sleeve. We must remember, he is saying, that all wars bring at least a part of the world to the brink of chaos after they're over. The communists in the Kremlin are just as aware of that as we should be. They know, also, that inevitably chaos, post-war, must end, and order must begin again. And they think the coming winter is their last chance, for the time being, to take the industrial plant of Europe, the know-how of its scientists and workers, to take it for free, at no cost to themselves. They're making their extraordinary effort, therefore, he went on, in strategic France and Italy, to outflank us before winter, perhaps during the winter or early spring. If they fail then, they'll turn to their own unfinished business of rehabilitation and let us and Western Europe alone until the next period of crisis, perhaps a depression. Thus spoke a man with hash marks of long experience. Since that date, his prescription has been filled, his guess borne out down to the dotting of the last I, the crossing of the final T. We'll have a report from France, if the signal's good, in a few minutes to bear out his statement there. Curiously, he did not limit his observations to Europe. It's all peoples, all governments, after a total war, who must pass through a trying, difficult period. And in that period, to carry his reasoning a step farther, the strain falls upon average citizens, poor citizens, rich citizens. It falls on government, business, labor, farmers. If it's not a case of too much money, it's too little. If it's not inflation, it's deflation. If it's not the ins in politics, it's the outs. Let's run down today's news on this score. The question always is, remember, how far should government intervene for citizens? How much of the burden of readjustments should the citizen himself bear? In Washington today, all our adjustment troubles were laid bare one by one. Listen to some of the testimony and action on Capitol Hill. Housing, for example. Edward E. Brown, blunt-speaking president of the Federal Reserve Board's advisory councils, asks us citizens to take it on the chin, to avoid heavy government services in our behalf. War veterans, he said, to Congress and other home hunters would be better off living in a tar shack for a year or two instead of paying $11,000 for a house that should cost five. Next, fuel that goes into our cars and homes. The Senate Banking Committee is looking into the shortage of fuel oil, gasoline, coal before the winter strikes. It's another case of government trying to find out how far it should go toward becoming the citizen's keeper. Witness after witness said the trouble was tankers, tank cars, steel to make them. The bottleneck is transportation, not shortage. The Senate committee decided to name a special oil industry committee to make recommendations, either for more steel for tankers and cars, by voluntary action or rationing, by industry or by consumers. The question again, how much government, how little? Next, basic commodities, food, steel. The Truman administration submitted to the Republican-controlled Congress today a sweeping plan for price control and rationing of all foods, a plan to have on the shelf, just in case. The Republicans rejected the plan out of hand. They argue that the time is not yet. By tomorrow, or in a few days at least, Speaker Joseph Martin says the majority will get behind a double-barreled, voluntary plan of its own that will keep government somewhere in the background and stress citizenship and responsibility. The number one prescription will be a waiver of the Sherman antitrust law, however, government action, to allow industry-wide price fixing so long as that price fixing lowers the cost of living and does not raise it. Next, the president himself would be empowered to control exports, to balance them against our domestic needs. Now, money. Here again, the administration wants special bank reserve, restrictions on consumer credit, bank credit, and so on. The Republicans say no. Abroad, of course, it's the same story, but in accent grave. There, governments are not strong like ours. They are weak. The weakest are kept in power by the presence of armed forces in one guise or another. For example, the troops of four allied nations keep Austria from flying apart. But Austria is not standing idly by. The government of Austria is taking full advantage of the presence of military force. The Austrian government is practicing not voluntary methods, but financial surgery to reduce the velocity of money based on wartime spending. Tomorrow, financial reform begins. Today's shilling must be turned in 3 of today's for 1 tomorrow. That's drastic, and it will hurt the people of Austria. But they must have reform. Then there's that case of France we spoke about. Here's Henry Cassidy in Paris.
It's now 5:20 a.m. Wednesday over here. The subway stations have just opened. The central markets are pouring out food to all of Paris. The streets that have been gathering refuse for weeks are being cleaned. Men are trudging to work through the gloom of a mild early December morning, and all this activity translates into real human terms the most important defeat the Communist Party has undergone since the war. For a month, the Communists, through their General Confederation of Labor, have tried to paralyze France. But during this night, they admitted defeat, and they called off their strikes. The Labor Confederation has accepted a compromise offer on wages from the government and has ordered its followers back to work this morning. The government is stronger than ever, and France is now in a position to cooperate more than ever in the Marshall Plan for recovery. An unusually clear explanation of the surrender is given by the man behind the strikes, Benoit Frachon, Communist Secretary of the Labor Confederation, in this morning's edition of L'Humanité, official organ of the Communist Party. He admits that after a peak figure of 3 million strikers, only 1.5 million were out when the strike committee gave what he calls the order to retreat. In other words, the firm anti-strike action of the Schuman government had its effect. But Fachon says the strike committee ordered the return to work only because tomorrow, which in French means any time in the near future, we shall need all our strength to fight. This is Henry Cassidy in Paris.
Here in America, we have only the faintest trace of the ideological struggle that plagues other and weaker governments. But that trace makes big headlines. Here's John Storm in Hollywood.
The 10 Hollywood writers and directors who wouldn't talk when Congress asked questions and then got indicted and fired from their movie jobs are fighting back. They won't go back to Washington for trial on charges of contempt of Congress without a struggle. And they're going to sue the motion picture companies which discharged them from their jobs. The indictments have been issued. The procedure now is for the government to arrange an extradition hearing before a federal commissioner here in Los Angeles. Then, according to Robert Kenney, the attorney for the group, the defendants will argue that the congressional indictments are invalid. In brief, their position is that Congress had no right to inquire into their political or union affiliations, and that they committed no crime in refusing to say whether or not they are communists. If the federal commissioner says they will have to answer to the indictment, they'll head east for a formal court trial. But if the commissioner should uphold Kenney's contention that no crime has been committed, then the government may take the case to the Supreme Court. The defendants contend that Congress has no right to ask any such questions, and that anyway, the question about communist membership was not pertinent to the inquiry. And that hits right at the heart of congressional prerogatives and powers. As for those civil suits against the movie studios, they haven't been filed yet, but they're in the making. Basis for the suits will be that the studios broke their contracts with the writers, and some whacking big damages may be demanded. This is John Storm in Hollywood.
In the United States, the backwash of war has also left with it a, to us, different, a human kind of a burden that we all can bear and be the better citizens for it. Here's W.W. Chaplin in New York.
Children all over Europe are in need of fathers and mothers. 5,000 of those children have American foster parents, the kind of parents you can be too for very little cost. Write a letter to the Foster Parents Plan for War Children, Post Office Box 147, New York, and see how much you will get for that little cost. Today, 5 of those foster children arrived in New York by air so that they can go back to Europe and spread the word about this lovely land, jam-packed with potential foster parents. Here with me tonight, I have one of the foster children who arrived today and his foster parent, Minerva Pius. Perhaps you know her better as Mrs. Nussbaum of Fred Allen's Alley. Her foster child is Giuseppe DeLillo of Cassino. His parents and 9 brothers and sisters died there in the bombing. He lost a leg. He is 12. Miss Pius, this foster son of yours, he has relatives here?
Yes, he remembers his parents writing letters to relatives in America and seems to remember this name and address. His grandfather, Severio Areola, 818 Melrose Avenue.
Here in New York?
Well, he thinks so, but America and New York are all the same to Giuseppe.
There are many Melrose Avenues in America. I'm sure our listeners will canvass them. Look for Severio Areola, whose daughter Angelina Serpico married a man named DeLillo. And now, Miss Pius, on this short acquaintance, how does your foster son like America?
Well, I don't speak much Italian, Mr. Chaplin, but I'll try. Giuseppe, le piace America?
Sì, meraviglioso.
He thinks America is wonderful. Meravigliosa. So many others would like foster parents like Miss Pius. Write to the Foster Parents Plan for War Children, Box 147, New York, and find how you, too, can be one. This is W.W. Chaplin in New York, and that's what happened in Human Relations today.
Morgan Beatty will return with some more late news. Are you going out for the evening? Remember, late hours and late refreshments may add up to a headache or an acid stomach upset tomorrow morning, or maybe both. So check into that supply of Alka-Seltzer before you go. Be prepared to enjoy the pleasant, welcome kind of relief that always can be yours the Alka-Seltzer way. Get Alka-Seltzer at any drugstore in either the 30 or 60-cent size package.
Mother, are you having trouble getting your growing children to take their vitamins this winter? Try giving them one-a-day brand multiple vitamin capsules. Each one-a-day brand multiple capsule contains all the vitamins for which the amount needed for grown-ups and children has been established. What's more, one capsule every day is all they take. And one-a-day brand multiple vitamin capsules are low in cost. A full 2-month supply for only $2. Ask your druggist for one-a-day brand vitamins, good for growing children and adults. Remember, for vitamins the easy way, for vitamins the thrifty way, the brand you want is one-a-day.
Now, here again is Morgan Beatty.
And here are signs of our times, Baltimore. Mrs. Dorothy C. McMahon asked the court for a divorce today after a marriage that lasted only 5 weeks. At the end of that time, said Mrs. McMahon, her husband left and gave her a check for $100. But why, asked the court. The check bounced, said Mrs. McMahon. Divorce granted. Chicago, young Raymond Clark from the hills of Kentucky appeared before a boys' court judge today. The charge, buying liquor before he had reached the age of 21. How old are you, asked the court. Well, said Raymond, I might be 19 or 20 or even 21. I don't know how old I am. My mammy never told me. Case dismissed. Salt Lake City, Utah. The state treasurer got a letter today with a $10 bill inside. The letter said, I took 2 road signs while touring Utah several years ago. Here's the money for those signs. The letter was signed, A. Traveler. Seattle, Washington. Captain Frank Nash was piloting his fishing boat Viewpoint today on the way to what he hoped would be a big catch off the coast. He got as far as Cape Flattery. Along came a tanker and rammed his stern. The Coast Guard tonight is looking for a hit-and-run tanker. And that's the news of the world. This is Morgan Beatty speaking for Alka-Seltzer, saying goodbye from Washington.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.